Time to finish up. We got up to slide 8, but I haven't mentioned anything about this yet. This introduces something new that I don't want you to confuse with something we've already talked about. So first of all, let's talk about where we left off last time. I don't remember whether it was where we left. Yeah, I guess it was. We talked about sex-linked genes, right? What is a sex-linked gene?
It's part of the sex chromosome.
Right. That's all that phrase means. Sex-linked gene means simply a gene whose locus, where it is, in other words, is on a sex chromosome, as opposed to an autosomal gene. Most genes are autosomal genes simply because there are a lot more autosomes than sex chromosomes. But a sex-linked gene doesn't have to have anything to do with sex determination. The chromosome is called a sex chromosome because it has something to do in that species with determining sex of offspring. But the gene doesn't necessarily have anything to do with that. It's just simply on the sex chromosome. And it makes sense to talk about an individual gene as being sex-linked or not. It's any given single gene is either a sex-linked gene or it's an autosomal gene, because every gene has to be on some kind of chromosome, and any chromosome is either an autosome or a sex chromosome. That has nothing to do with what we're looking at here, though. What we are looking at here is something that brings up linked genes or gene linkage. And that's why I say it's potentially confusing, because both the phrases use the word link. Well, it doesn't make any sense to talk about a single gene as being linked. It makes sense to talk about a gene being sex-linked, but not linked. They're totally different things. You have to be talking about two genes if you say that these genes are linked. And for genes to be linked means simply that those two genes, whatever they are on the same chromosome. And it doesn't matter what kind of chromosome. You can have two genes on an autosome. They are linked because they're on the same chromosome. You can have two genes on a sex chromosome. They're linked because they're on the same chromosome. All right? Now let's talk about what's happening in this cross. This uses fruit flies again, but nothing to do with eye color in this case. We have two characteristics here that we're paying attention to, only two, which one of which is body color, and the wild type body color is gray. It also happens to be the dominant color. The mutant color is black, which also happens to be recessive. That's one characteristic. The other is wing shape. And the wild type is, once again, also dominant, and the wild type is full wings, like you see in this individual. The mutant version of wing shape is called vestigial wings, which are very small, little nubs, and they are recessive. All right, so we have two characteristics, each of which has two traits, and one of those two traits completely dominates over the other, so there's nothing new about that situation. It's just a different set of characteristics that we're looking at compared to other ones we've talked about. And if you look at the genotypes here, once again it uses this kind of backwards notation like for eye color, where the letter actually stands for the recessive, not for the dominant. So B is for black, VG is for vestigial wings. But if you have a plus superscript, that means instead of actually being recessive allele, it's the dominant allele. So B plus actually means gray. B by itself means black. VG plus means full wing, normal wing. And VG by itself means vestigial wing. So we have one parent that is a doubly homozygous dominant individual. True breeding gray and true breeding full wing. The other one is a doubly homozygous recessive individual. True breeding black bodied, true breeding vestigial winged. All right. So if you cross these two, which has been done, you should already, based on what you've learned, expect, since they're true breeding each, that all of the F1s are going to be doubly heterozygous, right? Because each parent is true breeding, therefore each parent can make only one kind of gamete. This one has to make a gamete with gray body allele and full wing allele. This one can only make a gamete with black body allele and vestigial wing allele. So when you get those two gametes together, you're going to have a genotype that is B plus B, VG plus VG, which is doubly heterozygous. Right? That's the normal for F1s. All the F1s are going to be the same. That's the only possible genotype. And this is just one of those F1s. Since both of these genes have complete dominance, and since gray is dominant over black and full wing is dominant over vestigial wing, then every one of the F1s will be just like this one parent, except only genetically different, heterozygous instead. But they're all going to be, all the F1s will be gray-bodied and full-winged. And that's also completely exactly like all the other crosses we've done. Now, though, we're going to do a test cross. Up before, we have been crossing an F1 with another F1 to produce an F2. That's not what's happening here. So you take an F1, and this one happens to be a female, and you cross it with a doubly homozygous recessive, which is just like one of the black parent originally, right? That's a kind of a test cross. But in this case, we're not doing a test cross to figure out what the genotype of this dominant one is. We're doing it for a different reason. But when you cross this F1 with a doubly homozygous recessive, the doubly homozygous recessive can make only one kind of gamete, right? Has to make, this is a male, so the sperm has to have black allele and vestigial wing allele. That's why the Punnett square has only one row on it. He can make only one kind of sperm with respect to these two characteristics. She, on the other hand, from the F1, is doubly heterozygous. So meiosis is going to pick randomly one body color allele and one wing shape allele. There's four possibilities then. B plus VG plus, B plus VG, B VG plus, and B VG. Those are these eggs. Okay? And when you get these eggs and sperm together, that produces these four zygotes. Now, there's four overall zygote categories here, but notice that two of these, the first two, are just like one parent or the other. This one is exactly like this parent in phenotype. This one's just like this parent in phenotype. So we call those kind of offspring parental type offspring. A parental type offspring is just like one parent or the other. These two, though, aren't like either parent. They have the trait from one parent for one characteristic and the trait from the other parent for the other characteristic. So it's like a mix and match, right? This is gray just like one parent, but vestigial wing like the other parent. This one's black like one parent, but full wing like the other parent. So the ones that are not like either parent belong to a separate category. They're not parental types, they are recombinant types. Because the parental traits have been recombined to produce them. Okay. That's just a little bit of background now. The reason this cross was being done is to try to determine whether or not the two genes here, body color gene and wing shape gene, are linked. Meaning, are they or are they not on the same chromosome? That's what linked means. Well, we have some predicted ratios based on whether or not that linkedness is true. If genes are located on different chromosomes is just another way of saying if they are not linked. Right? Well, if they are not linked, then you should expect all four of these possibilities. Because the reason linkedness matters is that genes are not acting in isolation. Genes don't move independently from one daughter cell to another. Chromosomes do. Each chromosome is carrying a bunch of genes. So if two genes are on the same chromosome, they're passengers on the same vehicle, and they're going to go together. But if they're on different chromosomes, then they could randomly go together because the two chromosomes go together, or they could go to different cells because the two chromosomes happen to separate during meiosis. That's why if they're not linked, you should see all four possibilities. And they should all equally be probable. That's why the predicted ratio, if these two genes are not linked, is 1 to 1 to 1 to 1, as the Punnett square shows. Right? In other words, you should get just as many of each as the other. Okay, well, if they are linked is this second if. If genes are located on the same chromosome and parental alleles are inherited together, that means they're linked. If they are linked, then you wouldn't expect any recombinant types. Because being linked means the allele for body color goes along with the allele for wing shape. And so you're going to get both together from one parent. You can't have a recombination. That's why the predicted ratio in the case of linkedness is 1 to 1 to 0 to 0. You shouldn't get these two types. It should be half and half parentals. Well, look at the actual results, though. I mean, either these two genes are either linked or they're not. There's no other possibility. So you would think that one of these two predictions would come true. But the real results are shown on the bottom. These are real numbers, number of flies that they got. And notice that they got a lot of flies. So the bigger your sample size, the closer you should be to a predicted ratio. But neither predicted ratio came true. There are some recombinants. So that right away throws up a flag because this one predicted none. But notice that it's not really anywhere close to 1 to 1 to 1 to 1, which if you're doing thousands of, should be very close to 1 to 1 to 1 to 1. Instead, you got a lot more parental types than recombinant types. So if they are actually unlinked, they're indeed on two different chromosomes, then there is nothing making one kind, recombinant or parental, more likely than the other, which means if they are truly unlinked, that it really should be 1 to 1 to 1 to 1. The fact that it's not means they're linked. But we did get some recombinants. So what could happen that you already know about that would allow two genes, two alleles, but from different genes, on the same chromosome, end up separating from each other and going into different cells during meiosis? What would do that? Exactly. Crossing over explains this. So let me quickly draw a picture. crossing over, remember, not only involves the crossover, but then they swap the downstream parts with each other. So this red part was blue in this otherwise blue chromosome, and this blue one is now part of this red chromosome. All right? What is that crossover point called? Keeping in mind that there's an exam coming up. It's called a chiasma. This is the chiasma. All right? Well, crossing over can occur anywhere along the length. That's why there's so many possibilities, and that's why crossing over just by itself leads to so much additional genetic variation because of sex. But we're saying these two are linked. Two genes can be linked by being anywhere on the same chromosome. So there's multiple possibilities there too. Let's say the two genes are here and here. Well, if it crosses over right here, then that's not going to separate them, right? They're still going to go together. And if they're right here and right here, they're still going to go together. The only way that two linked genes are going to separate from each other is if the chiasma forms between the two loci. In other words, if the genes are here and here, and the chiasma forms between those two positions, then they're going to go to separate cells because they're going to be now on different chromosomes. Does that all make sense? If two genes are linked, then they have two loci. The loci are their positions. And if crossing over occurs, it's only going to separate those two genes so that they go their own ways to different daughter cells if the chiasma forms between those two loci. Right here, you know, the chiasma is forming here. That's not going to separate if they're right here. It's not going to separate them if they're right here, but if they're the chiasma is between the two positions, then they will separate. All right, now, why is it that you would get so few recombinants? Because you get recombinants only if they do separate, which means only if the chiasma just randomly forms between those two loci. Well, if you had a position here and a position way at the other end, then just about any chiasma would form between them, right? Because there's so much room between them. The closer they are together, though, on the same chromosome, the less likely that a randomly occurring chiasma will form between those two close positions. Okay? And that's kind of explained in the next slide, slide 9. So this is the same cross, but now we're looking at just one chromosome type because that's the only one that's involved here since they are linked, right? We have two genes, but they're linked genes, so they're on one chromosome. We're ignoring all the other chromosomes, and the black lines are the loci, like I was drawing with tick marks. Only if a chiasma forms right between these two somewhere are these two going to be separated. If it forms anywhere out here or anywhere there, then they won't. And you'll get parental types in that case. You'll only get recombinant types if crossing over occurs between these two black marks. And that's less and less likely the closer they are together. They're linked either way if they're on the same chromosome, but if they're linked and very close together, you won't get very many recombinants. And that, decades ago, a grad student in genetics realized this and realized that it would be useful to try to figure out using math how close together two loci are for linked genes. This is, I say decades ago because now it's pretty routine to just sequence the DNA. We can look at the actual DNA easily now. But this was in the days when we could not do that. And so, you know, first you do crosses just to determine whether there is linkedness or not. If you're studying two genes and you do these crosses and you get reliably 1:1:1:1 ratios, then that means they're not linked. If you find, though, that you do get some recombinants, just not nearly as many, that means they are linked. But that brings up the question that, I mean, that's useful knowledge by itself that they're linked, but it would also be nice to know where they are relative to each other on the chromosome, which, like I say, is easy to do nowadays that we can look at the DNA, but not back in the day when you couldn't. So the grad student figured out, I can mathematically figure this out. He created what was called the recombination frequency, which is simple math. This 391 comes from 206 plus 185, the total number of recombinant individuals divided by the total number of individuals produced, all four of them added together. In other words, the fraction of them that were recombinant times 100 to make it a percent. In this case, 17%. And he figured out that the lower that percentage is, the closer the two linked genes must be to each other on the chromosome. And if you do this with multiple different genes, but considering them two at a time, you have to go through a lot of different crosses to do this, then you can do gene mapping. This was back before we could do it so easily now. For instance, in slide 10, here are three different genes. But you don't do this all in one shot. You have to do these crosses like we were talking about with the black body and the vestigial wing, which are two of these. You have to just consider two genes at a time, do separate experiments. That's the 17% we just figured. If you do body color and eye color, which is the CN is part of, then you find that's a 9% recombination frequency. Eye color and wing shape, 9.5%. And so it must be the case that the eye color gene is between these other two, right? Because this 17% means they're farther apart and therefore more likely to recombine. So doing this two at a time with as many genes as you know are on a chromosome can allow you to figure out, it's a lot of work, but allow you to figure out the gene map on that chromosome, where the genes are, which is what's shown in 11. I mean, it's just more and more information. It's the same process, though. So these are several different genes now. And the numbers are really just relative. Whatever one is at the farthest end that you know of, you just call that zero, and then the other numbers are relative to that zero point. But that's early gene mapping, just based on looking at actual offspring when you do real crosses. Nowadays, like I said, we can just look at the DNA, so it's not such a big deal. Okay, now 12. Hopefully you remember your meiosis. And meiosis, of course, involves two cell divisions, right? Meiosis 1 and meiosis 2. Before we talk about separations that can occur in meiosis, again, because we've already talked about this, let me give you a relevant definition here, a couple definitions. For any given cell, there is a normal number of chromosomes that type of cell should have for that species. Right? So, for instance, in your body, a somatic cell should have 46 total chromosomes because you're a diploid organism, and N for humans is 23, so you should have 46. A gamete that you produce should have 23 because a human gamete is haploid. So it should have just n total number of chromosomes. Anyway, whatever the cell type is for whatever species, there is a normal number of chromosomes. And if it has the normal number of chromosomes, then we say that cell is euploid. EU meaning true, just like in eukaryote, true or good. All right, that's the normal situation. And therefore, the opposite word, which you form just by putting AN in front of it, aneuploid, is any cell or the condition of a cell not having the correct number of chromosomes for that cell type and species. And so notice that aneuploidy, that condition, can result from either having too few or too many chromosomes. Either one is an abnormality, an aneuploidy. Well, aneuploidy can arise, it can happen because of errors in meiosis. So, back to a review of meiosis. What part of meiosis, in what part of meiosis does separation actually occur? Anaphase. But anaphase 1 and anaphase 2, they both have separation, right? Anaphase is the separation part of either mitosis or meiosis 1 or meiosis 2. Well, normally that goes off without a hitch. No problems arise. In other words, normally the separation does happen. And that separation, we can call it separation, but it's also called disjunction, which is simply another word for separation. To disjoin means to separate from each other. Disjunction is the normal process. And if that doesn't happen, then that's an error that we call non-disjunction. So here we have a cell with an N of what? What's N here? 2. That's why there are 2 tetrads lining up, or we don't see them lined up. That was already happened in metaphase, but 2 tetrads lined up. N tetrads line up. Well, this tetrad is properly disjoining. It's undergoing disjunction normally. One replicated chromosome is going to go to one cell, the other one's going to go to the other cell. But this tetrad is not. That's the one that's erroneous. It's undergoing non-disjunction. And when that happens, one of the daughter cells, the immediate daughter cells, is going to get both chromosomes, and the other one's not going to get either chromosome. And either of those cases is an aneuploid condition, right? So this daughter cell is already aneuploid, and so is this one. But this cell is aneuploid because it has too many chromosomes. This one has too few. Which of those conditions is the less likely to survive? What's a bigger problem, in other words, having too few or too many chromosomes? Too few, why? Isn't enough what? There isn't enough chromosomes is what is happening, but why is that such a problem? Right. If you don't have any of the chromosome, then all of the genes that chromosome carries are missing. And therefore, you aren't able to make any of the proteins that those genes indirectly code for. You're not going to be able to survive that. So that's definitely a problem, but it's also a problem having too many. Even though you have all the genes you need, having too many chromosomes can cause various problems. More tolerable, though. Anyway, these are already both aneuploid, and even if meiosis 2 then goes about normally, you're still going to produce gametes that are aneuploid because you started with aneuploid intermediate cells. That's if non-disjunction occurs in meiosis 1. But in the second example, you have meiosis 1 occurring normally. Notice these have normal disjunction. But then this daughter cell undergoes non-disjunction in meiosis II. So that's going to produce two gametes that are aneuploid from this cell, but this cell goes through the second step normally again, so two of these gametes are normal. All right, well, let's look at 13, which has to do with chromosomal mutations. We have talked about mutations several times already, but in almost all the, well, in all the cases up to now, we've been talking about small-scale mutations, whether they're point mutations, which involves just a single nucleotide pair, or other small-scale mutations that are just some small number of nucleotides. Keep in mind what mutation is. Mutation is a change in the genetic sequence. But you can change just a tiny piece of the overall sequence. That's still mutation. That's what point mutations are. Or you can change a big fraction of the overall chromosomal sequence. And that's what chromosomal mutations are. They are much more large scale than point mutations. A point mutation, if it occurs in a gene, because remember, it's really more likely that a point mutation is going to occur between genes, since most of your DNA is actually between genes rather than in genes. But anyway, even if it occurs in a gene, a point mutation is going to affect only that gene. Here we have chromosomal mutations, and there are various categories we'll look at here. I want to first, though, say that A, B, C, D, all these letters, those are not genes. This whole thing is a chromosome. A, B, C, D, and so on are just simply chunks of the gene. So A contains many genes. B contains many genes. They're just a piece of the chromosome. When you have deletion, what happens is that, for whatever reason, one big chunk gets taken out. So A, B, C, D, E turns into A, B, C, E, and so on. There's a loss of material there, just like there is for a deletion point mutation that we talked about. But this now involves many genes, and so that's going to be a big deal because you're missing several genes all of a sudden. Hard to survive. Duplication is the second one, and for whatever reason, this BC section got copied and the other copy got stuck right next to it. So A, B, C, B, C, D, E. That's much more survivable because you're not losing any genes. You're adding some copies of some genes, though. And that might be problematic, but maybe not. It just depends. This happens, actually, there's evidence that it's happened quite a bit. Because it's survivable, since you're not losing any genes, it actually, if it doesn't cause problems with living, it kind of gives natural selection a chance to, not intentionally, of course, but a chance to mess around with these other copies and see what happens. Because if they mutate, no big deal. You still have your other ones to work with. But mutation might just randomly improve things in the copies. So that does happen, actually, in nature. Inversion, to invert means to flip over, is going to change BCD into DCB. So that isn't any loss of loss or gain of DNA, but it's a rearrangement. There's a couple things to say about that. First of all, the boundary between A and B here, and between D and E, these black lines are where it gets cut. And it could happen that that cut occurs right in the middle of a gene, right? In which case, the gene will be destroyed, so that would be a big deal. But it's pretty likely, since genes are spaced out, there's a lot of sequence between them, that this cut won't actually occur within a gene. But that still can be a big deal because the non-coding sequence of DNA, the stretches between genes, part of their function is to, in various ways, allow for proper control of gene expression. So they aren't genes themselves, but they're important for allowing the genes that are nearby to be turned on when appropriate and turned off when appropriate. That's gene expression, control of gene expression. And therefore, an inversion, even though it doesn't lose you any gene information, could allow a gene to be turned off permanently or turned on permanently. Either one of those is a bad thing. So it can cause problems. And the most complex of the four that are shown here is reciprocal translocation. It's more complex because it involves two different genes. Now, importantly, these are not homologous genes. These are two different types of genes. Right? So they don't correspond to each other, but they're swapping some pieces with each other. This is not like crossing over. Crossing over is more or less intentional swapping between homologs. So they're swapping the same kinds of genes. These are totally different genes controlling totally different characteristics because they're on totally different types of chromosomes. But it happens now and then. And so once again, you're going to get the same kind of problems you can with inversion because you might mess with the proper regulation of gene expression. Well, 14 is just a specific example in humans of reciprocal translocation that, for whatever reason, happens fairly frequently, involving chromosome 9 and chromosome 22 that are supposed to be like this, but a piece breaks off of each and gets swapped to produce what's called the Philadelphia chromosome. In this chromosomal mutation, it's called the Philadelphia mutation. The specific problem that this causes is leukemia. There's a lot of different ways that you can get leukemia otherwise. This doesn't have to happen, but this is one way that leukemia can arise. Well, that brings us to the final slide of the term, which has to do with an epigenetic effect. I didn't give you this word before, but we've actually already considered an example of an epigenetic effect or epigenetics. Epigenetics refers to a situation in which a phenotype change occurs without there being any change to the DNA. So if there is a change to the DNA sequence, that by definition is mutation, right? And of course, mutation can affect phenotype. We've talked about that with sickle cell disease and so on. That's not what epigenetics is, though. There is no change to the DNA sequence. There's something else that's happening, though, that can cause a change to the phenotype, despite having no change to the DNA. Well, the example that we already considered, even though I didn't call it epigenetic at the time, was X chromosome inactivation that we already talked about. Remember the cat example? If one of the two X chromosomes in a female is coiled up so much that it's inactivated, well, the DNA sequence doesn't change, so it's not mutation, but it does affect the phenotype in a heterozygous cat, as we looked at. So that would be an epigenetic effect. Here's another example, though. This is called genomic imprinting. And it's kind of similar to X chromosome inactivation, except it's a single gene that is being inactivated, not a whole chromosome. And we've discovered several genes that are imprinted this way, but it's still the minority of genes. Most genes are not imprinted. What happens, it depends on the gene, but a lot of times what inactivates them is methylation. When we were back in the chapter in which we first talked about functional groups, methyl being a functional group, remember, I told you that methylation is one way to control DNA. You hook a bunch of methyl groups onto the DNA at a gene, and that will keep the gene from being expressed. So it inactivates that gene, and that will remain inactive for the lifetime of that individual. It can be unmethylated before it gets passed on to an offspring, but for that individual's lifetime, it will be turned off. And imprinting turns the gene off, or I should say an allele off, not an entire gene, but one allele in a diploid, because a diploid has two alleles for the gene, right? One on each of the two homologous chromosomes. Imprinting turns one of the alleles off, and it turns it off based on the parental origin of that chromosome. Right? A diploid has two chromosomes of the same type, one from its father and one from its mother. In imprinting, it matters which parent gave that chromosome to the offspring as to which one's going to be turned off. So there's two versions of imprinting. Maternal imprinting, in which case the father's version gets turned off, and paternal imprinting, in which case the mother's version gets turned off. Here we're looking at paternal imprinting in mice. This is a homozygous mouse. It got two alleles from its parents, one from each parent, so it has a maternal chromosome and a paternal chromosome and a maternal chromosome. But since this is paternal imprinting that we're looking at, that means the maternal version, whatever it is, gets turned off. Well, this is a homozygous mouse, and so it doesn't really matter which one you turn off, but it's the mother's that gets turned off. And since these were both the normal version of this gene that codes for a growth factor, then this one that is still active is going to allow this mouse to be normal size. You have two examples down here for heterozygous individuals, though. This heterozygote got a normal version from his father, so that's the one that's going to be left on since it's paternal imprinting, and a mutant form from the mother. Well, the mother's version gets turned off, so this mouse is normal. But if you have the other kind of heterozygous individual, in which case the mutant form got inherited from the father, that's the one that's going to remain on, and the normal one from the mother gets turned off, so that makes this mouse small. Doesn't get as big because it doesn't make the correct version of the growth factor. That is imprinting, which is epigenetic. So now you know everything you need to know to get 100% on exam 5. Before that, though, get 100% on the practicum today. Yes, that's the day. And by the way, that's at 11:30. Unlike normal lab days, I won't be opening the door early. So don't freak out that it's locked until 11:30. I have to make sure that the setup, which I don't do, is correctly set up. But anyway, just be in the area of the door at 11:30, and I'll open it and have more to say then. See you then.